The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Peak Prosperity podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and this is a really special day we have right here because this is the first ever use of this studio for having an in-studio guest. Very excited to have this particular guest today because turns out one of the perks in this business of mine, which is you get to meet amazing people and some of them become your friends. And that's the case of what's going on here today. Today we have in this amazing new studio with us, Jim Kunstler. Jim got me on the track with something called The Long Emergency, which if you haven't read it, you really should. And I was 2005, six or something, I started really falling into this idea of connecting the three things, which became ultimately in 2008, the crash course, right? Connecting the economy, energy, and environment into one spot. And once you do that, or once I did that red pill moment, I couldn't see the world the same way. And the biggest part of that story is how we as a society, as a culture, as a species are really dependent on energy. You know, it's just quaint old notion. It's not Bitcoin. It's not, you know, new pharma products. It's not going to Mars. Like all these sort of fantasies we have that was what defines us. When you strip that away, it's energy. Energy is what defines us, just like every species. So that got me started on The Long Emergency and was a great book, is a great book, and takes you through really the connection between what peak oil really means for our culture and what that implications are for the future. So this particular guest, very happy to have him here today. He's a very prolific author and Living in the Long Emergency. Is that your latest book, Jim?
Yeah, it came out about a year ago.
Fantastic. So how's that book being received?
I have no idea. You know, believe it or not, I don't follow my numbers at all. I never looked at
it. I don't believe it.
I never look at that stuff.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I got a literary agent, you know, but I mean, I figure it'll only depress me. So, you know, whatever it is, I just, you know, I wait for the checks. And my personal pronoun, by the way, is pay to the order of.
So, okay, it's good to have personal pronouns in this day and age.
I must say, though, I'm a little skeptical that books per se are going to continue a whole lot longer as a valued medium in our society. I'm just not sure. The business of publishing books seems to be kind of unraveling, and in similar strange ways that the other things in our culture are unraveling. For example,
connected.
Well, it's just that you know they're manifestations of the way that peculiar deformities present in a system that's under tremendous stress. So, for example, the book publishing industry is under a lot of stress. What's one of the interesting symptoms? Well, one of them is that guys like Barack Obama and Hunter Biden get multi-million dollar book advances, and guys like me get lunch money, you know? So that's making it very hard to just conduct your life as an author. I'm not really complaining too much because, you know, I have managed my own sort of transition into digital publishing for now. But, I mean, we have no idea where this is going, what kind of, what the next transition might be. And I have fantasies about having to start a local broadsheet newspaper, you know, like Ben Franklin, in the event that things go a little bit deeper.
I know somebody who's done that, and they're very successful. They distribute to 100,000 households with a regional newspaper magazine, actually.
Well, that's amazing because there are a lot of local newspapers, and mostly they're the most odious and imbecilic rags.
Not this one. This one's really amazing. So I'll connect you up with. You should actually, you know, you might write for this guy too.
Well, that would be fine. But I'm so impressed at how little I know about what's going on in my own community, because the actual newspapers that used to exist over up in my corner of upstate New York,
That's all on Facebook now, right? That's how people find out about what's going on.
Well, that may be. I am on Facebook, but I never use it to find out what's going on. So I don't know. I may be missing out on something. On the other hand, It may be a good thing that I don't have that extra mishigas in my life to mess my head up. You know, the question is how do you make a living? How does that become a sustainable business as a newspaper?
Well, they have a circulation of 100,000. They're doing, I think, okay.
Well, people paying for it because the local papers where I am are all giveaways. You know, they're basically cat litter box liners.
Yeah.
With advertising.
Yeah, we have that. We have the Penny Saver.
It
doesn't do much. So I want to get back to the stress that the book industry is under, which you would know a lot about. Is that because people aren't reading as much because the digital media sort of like given them
attention
problems?
Oh, yeah, they're just distracted.
Or is it that people don't wrestle with ideas anymore?
I think that's a byproduct of having your attention span compressed so much that you can't carry through a series of fairly elaborate ideas to arrive at a workable conclusion about anything. and it ends up being having a terrible effect on your society, don't you think?
Well, I do, and it's become particularly troublesome, and I know you're going to be the perfect person to talk to about this, because we have I don't want to turn this left-right necessarily, because it's not political, but there's a strain of people out there who are now crowing about, like, you have to follow the science, but they actually are not following the science, and they're doing it in the same way that, like, so right now, there's a couple of words that I can't talk about here, even in this interview, if I want this to go up on YouTube, because YouTube has an explicit policy that I'm not allowed to talk about two specific drug off patent, very common, very safe drugs that actually have incredible benefit in treating certain unnamed viral diseases, right? So that you're watching me be all careful about this in the same way that Copernicus probably had to be careful about coming out with data. So I have data. I have randomized controlled trials. I've got mountains of data. I have 50 out of 51 trials all say the same thing from all over the world. This stuff works. And YouTube has taken it upon itself to say, you can't talk about that because that's not science or it's misinformation. Just no different than the church of the time coming out and saying, you can't say anything about how the sun and the earth is the center of everything. So I think that these people actually are not, they think they're talking about science. They've been programmed to believe that they're following the science, but they're not. They're actually disciples of religion. Mm-hmm. There's a religiosity that's infected this conversation. There's Pope Fauci, and what he says is infallible. He said it. I'm going to relay it to you as if I just am telling you pearls of wisdom. But it's not. It's anti-science. And all you have to do, you talk about these complicated trains to get to a position. Mm-hmm. All you have to be able to do is read a science paper and connect one dot to a second dot. That's it. That's all the complexity I'm talking about. And that's stumping people.
Well, science papers are particularly problematic because they have a certain extreme formality that's hard for people who are not trained and don't have any grad school experience to really be able to follow. But, you know, there are certainly more easily understood narrative vehicles for that on the internet and in print, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's a larger process of misinformation going on, and it's very hard to understand. What you have to probably conclude is that what comes into the picture is intention, and that is intention to mislead. And what we're seeing that
by whom
that seems to be so tragic is that the better educated managerial class in our society, that it's become okay for them to misinform the public. And not only has it become okay for them, it's developing into kind of a standardized protocol for lying to the public. And, it takes the form of what people might crudely identify as tyranny mm-hmm. or tech tyranny. Mm-hmm. But, there's a method to it. A lot of it is transparently dishonest and transparently carried on in bad faith. Mm-hmm. Like the machinations of Twitter and Facebook,
right?
Which everybody can see through, you know, especially when their claims are that, you know, you're making a scientific, you're making unscientific claims. when self-evidently they are scientific and they're correct. It's just that they have, for whatever set of reasons, the power to lie and the power to behave in bad faith, and so they do. They take that opportunity. You know, it really comes down to the bottom line of what is really affecting our culture the most harmfully.
Which is
the idea that anything goes and nothing matters. Well, and that grows out of living in a culture where there are no consequences for bad behavior.
Well, at the top. At the bottom, there's a lot of consequences.
Yeah.
Right? If you're a black man in a car, you might just get shot, right?
Yeah, but also, you know, well, I don't know. To me, that's another narrative story that I think has been twisted enough so that we forget that there are consequences for resisting arrest. There are consequences for fighting the police.
Philando Castile was a perfectly wonderful, well-behaved black man who said, hey, I've got a concealed carry permit. He has his hands up, and the cop says, show me. He starts to, you know, reach and gets shot, right?
Well, yeah, look, sometimes that has happened in very rare cases. You know, the number of cases where tragic incidents like that happen has been very, very small. And, you know,
not compared to Norway or the UK, where they just don't do it. I mean, we have a militarized police system, which you know, started under Obama big time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have police that are very militarized and antagonistic, and they escalate and they don't de-escalate and all that stuff. That's a thing. That's
yeah,
a cultural
but look, you know, I happen to be very sympathetic to the idea that these guys are in a position where they often have to make decisions in a fraction of a second.
Yeah.
And that happens,
and I won't disagree. And I'm a big believer in this statement that you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. So mm-hmm. Here's what I would want. Let's imagine there's roughly 2 million policemen out there. Bell curve time, some of them are going to be bad apples.
Correct.
And you have these police benevolent associations that protect all of them with equal vigor.
Correct.
And here's what I would want. I would just want, you got Beady McBeatface, the bad cop, right? You know, he's just awful. He just has a long track record of being just bad. You want him weeded out, but he gets protected all the time. So what I would want is when this happens and there's a civil judgment against Beady McBeatface that's deserved, that comes out of the retirement accounts of the Police Benevolent Association, all the existing police, and they get a little letter once, you know, a month in the mail that says, hey, your check is $3.38 less because BD McBeatface just did something again. And that doesn't get topped off by the taxpayers.
That's a great solution, that would be a great program. And, I agree with you.
Right, and then maybe that person, then they have to carry insurance, like a doctor, like a bus yep. driver, like somebody who gets in lots of accidents and does malpractice or whatever. And next thing you know, Beady McBeatface can't afford to be a cop and carry the insurance they have to carry yeah. because the consequences, the incentives, the outcomes have followed them.
I must say that, you know, a lot of these incidents that we're talking about now, the ones that really generated BLM, a lot of them involved officers who were trying strenuously to be as polite as they could. You know, they weren't necessarily Beady McBeatface.
So let me join you on your side of the conversation, which I believe, which is that there's a narrative machine running that is doing everything it can to keep parties fighting each other. So we've seen all the BLM protests. You know what we haven't seen? Not one protest against a group of people who destroy a million families a year. That's the medical insurance business.
Yep.
Where's my protest about that, right?
Look, I got to say something rather brutal and vulgar, and I'm sorry, but, you know, it amazes me over the last two decades that we've had so many school shootings and not one shooting in the finance office of a hospital. How many lives they've wrecked.
Exactly.
In this dreadful racket that medicine has become, this odious racket.
It's beyond awful. But the narrative machine, the CNN, the New York Times, the Foxes, all of that, they keep everybody really, it's sort of, they love the BLM police thing, because that's all the way down at the agent level. That's sort of like people, those are two rats in a cage, as I call it, right? These are individuals who live fairly shocked lives by a system that doesn't care about them and is sort of Machiavellian, if not Darwinistic. But rarely is it presented that it's actually the little people against the rich. That narrative is just kept out of sight, right? So that's been one of my big things, beating on the Federal Reserve for years and years and years, because they are purposely creating one of the largest and most dangerous wealth divides that we've ever seen historically. And they're not held to account for that. But they're absolutely reverse Robin Hooding, taking from everybody, giving to a few. And we have a system of media that supports that.
Well, so, you know, so much of this strikes me as not being a particularly conscious program by the so-called elites and the wealthy to oppress the rest of everybody else in America, but just a sort of a strange and tragic confluence of cultural trends.
I think it's more intentional than that, and here's why. Google can easily afford to buy doctors who could say, yeah, there's maybe some science behind these claims. They could easily afford that. Every quarter, I open up the Wall Street Journal. There it is on the front page. Google, record earnings, right? Facebook, record earnings. They could easily afford to have quality. So if you get a YouTube strike, which I did, right, because I talked about some things which was science-based, 100% backed up, I'd take it to court, I'd win, right? They said, this was medical disinformation. And there's no there. There's nobody that you can, like, appeal to. There's nobody on the phone that says, let me hear your case. There's nothing around that when they could easily afford that. They don't have no interest in that because they're interested in promoting a narrative. And that narrative increasingly is about, you have no power. You have no say in this whole thing. We tell you what's right and wrong. We set the narrative. Your job is to live into it and not make any noise. That feels intentional to
me. Well, also, you know, but it's very flimsy. It's a very fragile narrative, and it's now falling apart just in the week that we're talking.
How so?
The government, as represented by Dr. Fauci and the whole organization, health organization behind him, has been denying that there is any reality to the idea that the coronavirus was created in a lab on purpose. And not only created in a lab on purpose, but specifically to harm human beings by funding gain-of-function research. And they have strenuously denied that for the last 14 months. And all of a sudden, that story is absolutely falling apart. The notable thing about it is that the government, because of that behavior, has gone a long way in eroding its own authority just over the year of COVID. But now, you know, they're in a situation where they may erase their authority entirely by exposing Dr. Fauci and Dr. Fauci's misrepresentations of what went on. And, you know, a lot of this has been also transparently and self-evidently proven before the public for weeks and months before this, before Dr. Fauci actually came out and said this week, well, you know, maybe it was created in the lab and, you know, maybe it was a gain of function thing and maybe we paid for it.
Yeah, and I have videos of Dr. Fauci happily extolling the virtues of performing gain of function research. There's working groups on it. They talk about it. They've held conferences on it. I have this thing from 2015. He gives this long 40-minute speech about gain of function to a bunch of gain of function researchers, and they're talking about it. So it's a big, it's a thing, right? And so for people listening who don't know, gain of function sounds awesome. I would love to gain some functions, right?
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
Where can I get you know, $30 worth of that?
Yeah. Yeah. But in virology, gain of function is referring to gaining additional abilities to either be more transmissive or more lethal against various hosts.
But, you know,
those are the functions they gain.
The explanation for that is, oh, okay, it's dangerous, but we can learn from gain of function how to create better vaccines at some unknown point in the future.
Sure. And here's what they're not doing, though, is saying, what's the risk reward? So here's the benefit. We could learn more, and the benefit might be Y units, and we can articulate that. But what happens if this thing escapes from a lab?
Yeah, those of us on the sidelines.
This would be the X of, like, uh-oh, that's the cost. They never run that risk-reward ratio.
You know, and a lot of normal people are on the sidelines listening to that argument and saying, yeah, this is what you're doing? Are you out of your mind? Do you realize what kind of a Frankenstein experiment you're running? And, you know, it's exactly in the very nature of a Frankenstein experiment that Dr. Frankenstein believes that he's doing good for mankind.
All right, now I want to connect a couple dots because this has been a big week. Not only do we have Fauci suddenly backpedaling, but the week before, Bill Gates went from darling nerd trying to save the world to philandering womanizer hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein.